Any proposition to the end of class, turn them into me, Dan. I'd rather have you do that, Dan, than rather than walk up in the middle of class. What I'd like to do is I'd like to spend the first few minutes going over the test. You can see a little more. The median on the test was not really great. And then maybe the other class. Anybody very happy about a median on the test of 53%? I'm not. The overall grades in the class are curved, partly because the tests are somewhat harder than the homework, and therefore the average grades on the tests are lower than the average grades on the homework. I'm hoping that none of the rest of the tests have an average grade of 53%. Generally speaking, an average grade of about 70% is what is the norm in the class, and I'm very happy to have an average grade of 80%. However, the first test of a semester, you don't know what to expect of me, and therefore, and what kind of things we're going to be focusing and asking you to do for the test. I think I've told you kind of the problem-solving technique that I wanted you to show on the test. That's been a significant fraction of our discussion. But even then, the first test is usually, I don't know any semester when this has not been true, but it's possible that there's been others that have had particularly important tests other than the first test. The first test is almost always the lowest test. Now you know the good news. There's two pieces of good news. One, there's plenty of room for improvement. Two, you actually probably have the highest first grade test average of any semester I've had in the last 5 years. So feel bad about the first test, but don't feel as bad as previous semesters' classes probably have. I've had averages on the first test as low as 35%. So be glad that it's 55% rather than 35%. We wanted you to do a very specific format on the problems, and I will actually go through this as we go through the test, because this is what we are aiming for all of your recitation problems, which are practice problems for the test, and your test problems, because we think that there is if you follow a very systematic approach to these problem solving, you will do better on it. You'll be able to connect a specific problem to the overall idea. If I try to see your hand, I'll answer it. Ask your question in a second. We talk about this format, what we call the Weiss method, and we're pushing you very hard to use it. Now you'll see even today as I work through some problems how I try and make that a little bit more flexible. But we want you to write down the principle involved. We want you to very specifically write down those pieces of information that are given to you as knowns in the problem. We want you to write down, before you solve it, what the unknown is. That is being sought in that problem. So we think this is going to be a technique that is going to help you in the long run improve your problem solving skills. Now that's your question.
Can you give us our recitation?
I do. I have gotten the first batch of those, the first two sets back from the grader. I'm not going to put them in the same folders as the test problems. I will put them in a separate set of folders that I will probably bring and set on a side bench in class, and then they'll be sitting outside my office. I should have brought those with me today. I didn't remember to do that. I will make sure I bring them with me on Friday. I'm not sure what the grader will have this current set of recitation problems included for those, but you'll see kind of the feedback of what we expect to have on those. Good question. Let's go through the
test.
Shows the whole problem. Problem one, two parts. You notice I asked for you to write down the principle, the knowns and the unknowns, and very often some kind of diagram. I want you to isolate the unknown, meaning start out with an equation which you rearrange to, so you set the unknown on one side and all the knowns on the other side. Then you're going to substitute your numbers in and solve it. Usually you put a box around your answer. Very often I'll make some comments, yeah, the units seem correct, the magnitude's okay. So each one of those steps I've included in the process. This first one is one where they give you the potential through which an ion has been accelerated, and it decreases the potential energy. The fact that it's increasing voltage and decreasing the potential energy actually means that the charge has to be negative in this case. So Q is equal, it's a decrease in potential energy over the voltage, and it's 8.0 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. You remember that 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs is one charge on one electron, so that would be equivalent to 5 electrons. I think there's another. There's more than one version of the test. The other one ended up being exactly the charge of 2 electrons. Just to show that. The second one says, what is the speed of the ion after it is accelerated through the potential change? You'll notice that it's as going through the potential change, it's also going through that potential energy change. So we know that the change in potential energy is this value. We know that it starts from rest, so the initial velocity is zero. So what's the principle? In this case, the principle is conservation of energy. It's going to allow us to find the final velocity based on the change in potential energy. And we could have put the change in potential energy from above, or we could have just given it as the value here. Change in potential energy. The negative of change in potential energy is the change in kinetic energy. The initial kinetic energy is zero, so the final kinetic energy is all you need to have. That's 1 half mv final squared. Rearranging that equation gives the final velocity is minus 2 times the change in potential energy divided by the mass of the ion. You'll notice that because the potential energy is a negative number, that negative sign makes what's underneath the square root a positive number, which is actually important, or you'd have an imaginary answer. You solve it down, and this one gives, I got 1.3 times 10 to the fifth meters per second on this version of the test. The numerical value on the other version of the test is different. Thing. Now, okay, if we go to problem two, this one seemed to be in during the test time seemed to be the most difficult problem. We wanted you to use the capacitance equation to solve for one of the unknown quantities, and actually the two versions of the test. One of them solved for the separation between the two layers. The other one solved for, I think, the length of the roll. I don't remember. Yeah, it's the length of the roll. So in this case, again, the capacitor's capacitance depends on the area of the plates and the separation of the dielectric constant. Let's say this is the statement of the principle. We give the knowns. In this case, the length is known, the width is known, so that'll give you the area of the capacitor. Kappa is the dielectric constant. And in this case, the capacitance is known, and our constant epsilon zero is known. In this case, we want to find the separation. We want to find literally the thickness of the paper that separates the two metal strips. So you solve it. In this case, you're going to rearrange the equation, the capacitance equation, so that you solve for the distance. It's going to be the dielectric constant epsilon zero, length times width, that's the area, divided by the capacitance. Once you substitute in the numbers here and solve it, you get a value. This ends up being 1.4 times 10 minus 4 meters. Well, that we can evaluate if that is a reasonable value. Well, the thickness of a sheet of paper is a small fraction of a millimeter. 10 to the minus 3 is a millimeter, so this is a just over 1/10 of a millimeter in thickness. That's a reasonable thickness. Our units have come out right, so that seems to be a reasonable answer. Okay, the problem on the back is actually out of chapter 17. This is one where we want to solve Coulomb's law for electric fields for the strength of the electric field caused by two charges. One is charge Q2, the other one is charge Q1. The values in the different cases are different. In this particular case, Q1 is a negative value. Q2 is also a negative value for the charges. I think in the other version of the test, one is positive and one is negative, which gives you a difference in directions of what to solve it. So again, some statement of Coulomb's law is important, including the principle. The knowns are charges and the distances, and the constant. The unknown in problem one, we were asking for the electric field caused by Q1, which we'll call E1. That happens to be one that's because charge Q1 is a negative value, and it's along the x-axis, that means the electric field is going to be pointed directly towards it at the point of the origin, so that if I were to draw that as a vector, it would be an arrow pointing towards Q1, or when I solve to the end, that's going to give you an angle counterclockwise from the plus x-axis of 180 degrees or to the left. And I've isolated the unknown. I've written down the equation, which I don't have to rearrange. There's no calculation involved in that. Substitute in and I get a value. I do the same thing for the electric field caused by Q2. In this case, you notice I could have said for the principle it's the same as above, or in this case I just wrote that it's Coulomb's law. Again, my knowns are listed here. Here, I haven't listed in part one Q2 or R2 because they don't matter for part one. They do matter for part two. So I solve that. Again, I isolate it, then I substitute, then I solve it. So I'm showing the steps sequentially. This one is also a negative value so that it's pointed upward. And you'll notice that the length of the vector is going to have to be about 3 times as big as the length of the vector for Q1, for electric field 1. And so it's something like a ratio like this. And that means that if we are to graphically add the two of them together, you're going to have a total field that's some angle upward and to the left. Part D, or is part D, it should be part C. Oh, D and D, typo there. It's vector summation, addition of vector components. So I'm needed again that this is the statement of the principle. Our knowns are our electric fields. Our unknowns are the total vector length and its angle. And here I've actually written down the equations that would be used for that. So that would be, our first step of isolating the unknown. And here I'm substituting in for the electric field strength, and you'll notice that this number is slightly larger than the vertical component because the vector length is slightly longer than the vertical component. If I solve the angle, you'll notice that my x component is negative, my y component is positive, so if I get the arc tangent or the tangent to the minus 1 of this negative value, I plug it into my calculator and I get a negative 71 degrees. What direction is negative 71 degrees? Well, if I were to put that on my chart, that would be an arrow that points downward in this direction. So my calculator has actually given me an incorrect value because there are actually two directions that have that negative tangent. One is in the what we call the fourth quadrant down here to the downward and to the right, but the correct answer we've already shown graphically is upward and to the left.
So I have to add 180 degrees to that, or this one ends up being 109.8 degrees. So that's
the problem.
The last part is to actually take the electric field strength and get the force. You can actually go through the brute force of Coulomb's law calculation all over again, or you can simply notice that the force as a vector is equal to the charge times the electric field, and simply take the electric field you got from above and multiply it times the charge that you placed out there. And it turns out the charge here is the charge of a single proton or a single electron, two different versions of the problem. In this case, because it's a proton and it's a positive charge, the vector is going to be in exactly the same direction as the electric field vector, so the angle is exactly the same. If it was an electron, and I think the other version of the test has an electron, the angle is in exactly the opposite direction as the electric field direction, and so that it you have to add that 180 degrees back. Now you'll notice, and I should go back to the first problem because it shows it best. How are the points allocated on these problems? And I'll answer your question in a second. I may be answering that right now. The grader is told to allocate one point for writing down the correct principle. And there's a wide variety of ways you can write that principle and write it correctly. But you have to state something having to do, in this case, with potential and potential energy. One point is allocated for writing down the knowns and unknowns and the diagram. One point is allocated for writing down the correct equation entirely in symbols and isolating the unknown, so rearranging it algebraically to get that answer, to get it in the form you need. Then the proper substitution of the correct values gives you another point, and the final answer gives you another point. So you'll notice this is a five-point problem. Only one point is allocated for getting the correct numerical answer. You have to show all your work, and we want you to make sure you do that. Some of these problems are six-point problems, and therefore there's probably more involved in either the substitution or the allocation.
Writing down that equation down in the third or fourth step.
We want you to write out a sentence of what's happening. I think that, yeah.
In regards to piecing everything together, I understand that there's a whole bunch of equations, symbols that they start before you upgrade it to the final form. At the same time, we're rushed to finish complex questions. I mean, I wasted a lot, not wasted a lot of time, but I would have this problem finished. I would have to go back and like rearrange it, and that would leave me a significant amount of less time to actually do the problems.
The goal is not to make Greg's job easier. The goal is to show your work systematically. And I think that. Say again. The answer is yes. There are several different ways of solving. And there's one I didn't show on here.
The answer is, for example, the last one. I showed a specific way of solving this problem. You could have solved this problem from scratch using Coulomb's law and not use the electric field as part of your solution at all. The grader understands that there are other ways of doing it, but you still have to show how you used your method. And then there are valid other methods, and the grader is very well aware of that.
Your goal of helping, forcing us to like write the Weiss problem, step problem, is to help us out, not
right.
hurt us. And it appears to me like the people who are getting answers right and the steps right, or the physics right, they're getting penalized for not following steps.
Assuming
you're a genius, which I'm sure none of us here are the genius in physics, you could probably do it in your head. And if you got a genius, like say Einstein did it in his mind, he'd be penalized if you would have gotten an F in his test. And that makes no sense at all.
No. You want to show the point is we're trying to get you to carefully and systematically work through the problems.
Yeah, that's right. But if you mess up at the end of the answer, then it's your fault for you not seeing your abilities in the test. But if you actually get everything right, I only got one thing wrong, one angle wrong, and I got an F. That makes.
So what do you mean you got an F?
I got a 22 out of 40.
You got the median in the class, which is probably a C plus on the test.
That's still enough for me at this point.
Okay,
but like, so I mean, I'm getting penalized entirely for knowing the steps and like being smart about it.
I understand the objections. I'm not going to change. The answer is we want you to show your If you just simply put down a number, and a numerical answer, you've not shown me that you understand the whole process.
You're penalizing like intelligence. You're penalizing people.
No, I'm not. No. You're making. You're talking about a philosophical approach to the problems. You're going to have to use this method, and I'm not going to argue the philosophy of whether or not we use the method.
Your grader, like my principles that I wrote down were roundabout being basically what you wrote, but I didn't use your exact words, but I got no credit for it, like not even half credit.
Okay.
But I'm like, because like I got credit for one principle because I said conservation of energy, which wasn't even close to what you wrote. You wrote conservation of energy, and you wrote a longer paragraph. I got a full point for that, but for instance, on the other one, just because I used the word Coulomb's law, but I basically stated Coulomb's law, I got no credit.
I will accept back papers that if you, now I may be opening a can of worms, and if you hand them back to me and it's, you clearly have insufficient information, I'm not going to even give it back to the grader. But if you feel like the grader should have allocated a point or two more for very specific things that you know you got the correct answer, but he didn't give you credit for it, I will accept them back and have the grader look at them again. The same grader is going to look at them a second time, but he's going to give you a more careful look. But be careful handing them back, because I may say, no, that's not going to be sufficient. But I will accept back for regrades if you need to.
Yes, I should ask you as a person.
Would you grade me put like the 0, 1, 1, 1, physical in order?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know why the grader marks it that way. That's just where the points are allocated in your problem. I we've really spent enough time on this. Please come up to the end of class, and we'll go through more details if you really want to go through more on the test at that time. Yeah, I'm not trying to put you off, but again, I understand that your objections. We've chosen we're going to push this technique, and we want you to. I have every single time I've solved a problem in the class, I've emphasized that this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah,
and I expected that.
But you're trying to help these students, and then you end up hurting
me at the end of the class. I just don't have enough time right now in front of the whole class to solve this one problem. Okay, what I'd like to do today is go through some of the problem-solving skills for working with circuits. And sometimes circuits are very complicated. We've got either resistive or capacitive circuits. I try to find examples of some of the more complicated circuits you could find in the textbook. Here we've got one where you've got a battery that's connected to an array of four different resistors. The current's going to flow through one and separate and flow through several of the others. Here's another one that's even more complicated with a capacitor where the battery's connected and it's going to distribute charge on all these different capacitors. Here's another one that's a resistive network. Sometimes these very complicated circuits can be reduced to much simpler circuits using a systematic set of steps. So I'll spend a couple of minutes reviewing some of the ideas we've talked about. The concept of current and Ohm's law we're going to use. The definition of current is charge per time. Ohm's law says that there's a relationship between voltage and current flow through a resistor. If you know what the resistance is, you can find out what the current is, or the voltage. If you know two of these, you can find the other one. This equation, Ohm's law, is probably one of the most devilishly simple equations. You can find that in solving a problem, you can use the same equation in about four different ways to solve different parts of a problem, and you've got to know not only what it is, but how to apply it. And I'll show you some examples of that as we go through the problem. First of all, series and parallel circuits. Here we've got a voltage source, a battery in each case. Here we've got two light bulbs wired up, one in parallel, so that the current flows out of this and separates and goes through each of the light bulbs separately. So that's a parallel circuit. The other one is a series circuit where the current has to flow through one light bulb, then through the other light bulb, and then back into the battery. In one case, you have two separate current flows that have to add to equal the current that comes out of the battery. So the battery current is the sum of the currents through resistors 1 and 2. Here, in the series circuit, in the first case, the voltage drop across each light bulb is the full battery voltage. In the other case, you've got the same current flowing through each of the parts of the circuit, but now the voltage drop across each part is only, they have to add together to get the total battery voltage. So if you've got a parallel branch circuit, the currents have to add, and the voltages are the same across each, and so you get a... here's the voltage drop, the full battery voltage across each one of those, and you get an effective resistance equation that looks like this. So it's 1 over R effective in parallel is equal to 1 over each of the components. The series connections, in this case, the voltages across each of the two add. So you've got a voltage drop across one, voltage drop across two, but now the current has to be the same for each of those. And you get a resistance that you simply add linearly rather than as an inverse. I think I've done these before. I'm going to ask that question for you today. capacitor network, and again, this is one we talked about very briefly last class period. Here we've got a pair of capacitors. In this case, they're in parallel. And so now the charges on the two pairs of plates add up. The positive charges are going to be exactly equal to the negative charges on each plate. So Q1, there's a, if you think of the capacitor total, the total charge on the on a given capacitor is zero. But it's still charged up because it has, it's got a charge Q1 on that's positive on one side, exact equal and opposite on the other side. So we think of the charge Q1 as being what the value is on each of the, say, the positive plates. The voltages in this case are the same because the battery voltage is connected to one side of each of the capacitors, and the negative side, in this case 0 volts, is connected to the opposite side. If you do the combination to find out what the effective capacitance in this case is, the capacitors will add. In the series case, here you've got two voltage drops, one across capacitor one, one across capacitor two, and the sum of those is the battery voltage. But the charges have to be the same on each plate. Now this is probably the thing that is the most difficult to visualize, but I'll try and see if we can show you how that works. Think about the charge that is comes out of the battery and deposits on the positive side of plate one. That positive charge is going to attract to the plate that's right next to it an equal and opposite charge. So minus Q is going to be attracted to that same plate. You'll notice that the area between these two capacitors, the negative plate on capacitor one, the positive plate on capacitor two, and the wire between them is isolated from the rest of the world. And so to keep charge, the total charge in that region zero, the negative charge that is on this plate has to be exactly equal to the positive charge on this plate, which then attracts an equal and opposite charge, negative charge over here. So you'll notice that the charge on the positive and negative charges on this plate are exactly equal to the positive and negative charges on the other plate. And that's a property of series capacitors. And it really has to do with the fact that this area between them is isolated from the rest of the world. And so it has to have a total charge of zero. Oops. And then here's your effective capacitance. I'm going to spend time on that problem. I talked about problem solving with circuits, and I gave you a sequence of steps that we're going to look at in some detail. The first thing that I'm going to do, and I'm actually going to do this on the slides here on the PowerPoint, I'm going to take this particular circuit, which has a 9-volt battery, several individual resistors on it, and I'm going to, first of all, spread it out visually so it's a single line. And then I'm going to go through a sequence of steps which will reduce the number of components until I get a single resistor, or in fact, it works also for capacitors the same way. The easiest thing to do is to start out with a fraction of the circuit where I can prove that I can... look at the way I've written it. You must be able to fit that part of the circuit into a box with one wire going in and one wire coming out, and that what is inside must be all series or all parallel. So the easiest case is this particular pair right here. There's one wire coming into the box, one wire going out of the box, and what's inside, there's clearly two where the current has to separate and go through each of the two branches separately. So that's a parallel group of resistors. I can take that, the effective parallel resistance, and reduce that now to a single resistor. Once I've done it to a single resistor, I can take Now that single resistor in series with the 6-ohm resistor and reduce that so that now that's a single resistor. Now that's going to be found to be in parallel with the 10-ohm resistor, which I can reduce now to a single resistor, and so on. So the process is a stepwise process. Now you'll notice that I make a comment down here at the bottom. This only works for groups that are all resistors or all capacitors, and that there are some kinds of circuits that it doesn't work for. Our textbook likes to use a technique called Kirchhoff's laws, where you go around a loop and you add up all the resistances around the loop, and at every junction you find the currents in and out of the junction. I'm not going to have you do Kirchhoff's rules. Kirchhoff's rules are, I think, a much more complicated technique. You've got to be very, very careful with the positives and negatives on Kirchhoff's rules. And I find that for this class, Kirchhoff's rules are more difficult than the technique that I'm going to show you here. And so you will not be tested on Kirchhoff's rules, and you will not be given any circuits that are complicated enough that you would be forced to use Kirchhoff's rules. So I don't know whether you hopefully that I'm telling you that I'm not going to give you some of the most complicated kinds of circuits that are possible. I'm going to give you an example. Here we've got a set of 5 resistors where I've got current that I know is going to be, it's been connected to a battery on one side, the other end of the battery on the other side, so current's got to flow through this box from one side to the other. And I want to be able to do that process that I just said. I want to be able to take a box, has one wire going in, one wire going out, and all the components within it are either all parallel or all series. So here's an example. Let's see if I can try and put a box right here around this pair of resistors. Well, I've got one wire there, I got one wire there, and I got one wire there. That's 3 wires. I can't do that one. If I try the 2 there at the beginning, again, that's 3 wires. That didn't work. The top one, let's see, there's a box, one wire in, one wire out. Oh, now I got another wire coming out in between them. That doesn't work either. So this particular circuit, because I've got a current connection coming out on this side, is impossible. I cannot solve that one without using Kirchhoff's rule. On the other hand, let's say I have 5 resistors. Those look it looks almost like the same circuit, but here I've created a box, 2 resistors inside it, 1 wire here, 1 wire here. There's only 2 wires that go in or out of that box. But is that a parallel circuit or a series circuit? The current is actually going to flow in this side and down and back. So that's a series. That's actually a series circuit, even though it looks like those 2 are sitting in parallel. So you've got to be careful about them. But that's one that now you can reduce these 2 to a single resistor. Now if I replace that with a single resistor, now I can put a box that goes around this one and I have my new single resistor. That's going to be now being parallel. And then they're going to have 1 wire going in there, 1 wire coming out here out of my new box, and so on. So I can solve that stepwise. Let's go back to my circuit that I had drawn there. Sometimes it helps to be able to reduce that and see how the current flows through it. And I'm going to do the following. Let's look at that circuit. And I'm going to try. The first step that I said is try and simplify it so that it's in a format that you can see most cleanly how the flow of the current goes. And one of the ways that I can do that, I haven't done it on the screen there, but I can do it by hand, and let's see what happens. Let's take the battery, so the positive 9 volts of the battery, and put it over on one side of the screen here. And let's take the other side of the battery and the 0 volts and put it over here. So I've got wires that are going to go from, you're going to treat it as though you've taken the battery and stretched it out to the ends of the circuit. And now let's follow the path of the current as it goes out of the positive side through the resistor and then separate. So it's the first resistor here, the one that is called little r, is going to be the first one. And you'll notice that after it has gone through that one, or I guess that's R1, the way I've written it down, then it's going to go and branch into two branches, one of which goes to R2 is the 6-ohm resistor, R3 is the 10-ohm resistor. So let's see, that now branches R3 and R2, those two branches. And now, what happens afterwards? If we look at it carefully, after R2, it's going to branch and go through the 8-ohm with the 4-ohm resistors. Those are what I've labeled as R4 and R5. So this one now has R4 and R5. And you notice that I haven't, but until I finish it, I see that those two come back together. So I can connect those back together. And you'll also notice that R3 comes back together with them at that point. So I can draw that. I can either draw that as coming in here or coming in here. It doesn't matter. The equivalent. Then the R6, the 5-ohm resistor, R6. And you can see how the current flow might be through that circuit. You'll notice that one path that current can flow is through R1, R3, and then R6. You know that. Notice that some current's going to flow through R1, R2, and R5, and then back through R6. Some of it's going to flow through this path. So there's really a total of three completely different paths that current has to flow. You also should be able to see that there is one pair clearly that is in parallel with each other. And so now the first step in that process is I've got to find a group of resistors that are all parallel or all series. That's probably my principle. It turns out that I do that by putting a box around it where I've got one wire in and one wire out. That works. And it turns out it's R4 and R5. So that my isolating the equation is 1 over R4 plus 1 over R5. Is equal to 1 over the effective resistance of that pair, what I call R effective 4-5, or R 4-5. 1 over 8 ohms plus 1 over 4 ohms. Here's 1 over 8 ohms, 0.125 ohm to minus 1 inverse ohms. Here's 0.250 inverse ohms. And then I add the two together, 0.375 inverse ohms. And then I have to invert that again to get back my value for that particular resistor. So now I should be able to replace this pair of resistors with a single resistor. And so if I were going to simplify it, I would now find that I have R1, R3, R2, R4, 5, R6. Now I've replaced. Now I've got a single resistor where there were two before. Yes.
I don't think on the bottom you don't need the -1 since you already inverted it. Is that right?
This is 1 over this, and so when I invert that, it goes back to ohms. Yeah. Well, in this line right here, this is part is on the bottom of that fraction, so that when I've inverted back to get ohms back, I'm keeping track of the units throughout on ohms. Yes. Yeah, I've drawn it funny. I probably should have drawn it like this, 1 over 0.375. It still is inverse ohms when it's here, but if I'd have kept the inverse ohms up here, then... very often it is sufficient to write down the knowns in your drawing. You can do it as part of your drawing. That's one of the ways of doing it. Very often you'll want to write down your unknown as a separate. Good question. You'll notice that this kind of problem has most of the Weiss method in that algebra and solution step. And you'll actually go back and forth between the two. You'll notice here's all of this is algebra, and then I plug in my substituting in and get an answer. But now that's not my end answer. So now I've got to go to the next step. And I said, okay, now I've simplified it. I've got to replace and go through that same algebra substitution solve again to reduce it down. So I may repeat through that sequence, that subset of the Weiss method several times. So here the way I've done it is I've set it up so now I've got these two in series, a box around them, one wire in, one wire out. So now that if I want to solve for, because they're in series, I now have the series equation, R effective for resistor 2 and resistor, what I'm calling resistor 4, 5. So now that's the effective resistance of the three of them is the sum of those two resistances, and I add them together. All right, now I can replace that one. See, I can take this box and now replace it so I get R1, R3, R6, R6, R3. Now I've reduced it to a single one, R2, 4, 5. See, I've gone through that process of reducing it. Now it's useful to show my diagram again because I'm showing that I've reduced the problem to something simpler. I'll go through the steps. Here now you've got them, so you separate in to R2, 4, 5, and R3 are now in parallel. You reduce that down, so you get a single effective resistance. So now you've got a single resistor there. I'm walking through the steps faster than I'm showing each step. Now you can see that you've got a group of three resistors that are all in series. Those series resistors, you simply add them up and you get the value. So now you've reduced it to a single effective resistance. That process is a simplifying stepwise process, and you now have a single resistor which has the same overall resistance as several resistors that you've combined together in steps. You see how we do that process? In fact, while I've got it on here, let me actually bring up the... Let me put this on the screen so we can see this. I've got a circuit here of resistors. Right now what I've got is I've got a power supply here, the two pieces of those, a battery right here. I've got an ammeter that measures the current that's going to flow through it, and I can put different resistors, here they're big cans, a 1-ohm resistor here, let's try a 3-ohm resistor. Here's a 3-ohm resistor that I'm going to put so that the current's going to flow through it. Here the voltage is 7.3 volts. The current is 2.35 milliamps, and if you do the calculation, you can find that the resistance, V equals IR, you can calculate, ends up being, you can see that, 2.36 amps, and so you calculate that, ends up, the ratio between those two is 3 ohms. If I take a second 3-ohm resistor and put it in there, what is the? You'll notice that the voltage changes, but the same ratio is now going to take place. Here's two 3-ohm resistors. Two 3-ohm resistors added in parallel end up being 1.5 ohms. 1 over 3 ohms equals 2 over 3 ohms, or a ohm and a half. And now the ratio between this is 1.5. So you can see that I can add that, do that process. Here, let's see what happens if I take those two Again, this is going to be a 1.5 ohm resistor because I've got those two in parallel. I'm going to take a 2 ohm resistor that I can put in series with them. So 1.5 plus 2 ohms is 3.5 ohms. If I look at the ratio now, this ratio to this is 2.5. So I can, I can get the effective resistance of a group of resistors based on the voltage and current that flows through each of them. If I wanted to, again, I don't have to set up this way, but I could probably, let's see if I can do it. I don't know, I'm not going to try and do it here. I could, in principle, find out the current that flows through each of these branches by putting my ammeter in a slightly different place. In fact, I could do it where I disconnect it here, connect this up. Set this up here. Now I can get, if I want to, I've set this ammeter so it's in series with this particular resistor, and I can see that the current that flows through this branch is just under 1 amp. On the other hand, if I can do the same thing on the other one, I can find that the current flowing through that one is just over 1 amp, or it should be the same value, and so the sum of those two is the 2 amps that I had before. You can see that process. So, again, that's the process that you want to be able to show. You want to be able to show the current flow and voltage is related to those resistance drops. Saying that if I have a, so you've got, show me a, something like that, right? Let's redraw that particular group of resistors and see how that. Let me take this. And spread it out the same way I've done the other. Here you're going to have one battery pole. Let's call this point A and this point B. How would I spread that out so that's set up like this one is? Let's take point A. Point A is over here. You notice that there's three wires that come out. Let's just call it 1, R2, R3, R4, R5, just so I can add a number. A is going to come out and it's going to split R1, R2, and R4. So there's going to be three wires. So I draw it. R1, R2, and it didn't matter. I'm going to have R4 up here. It doesn't matter which order I've done them in. Now R1, after R1 is present, R3 is going to come after it. So R3 is right there. And then those two come back together to combine with R2. So you notice that one is drawn like that. And then R3 and R2, that's these two, they're going to combine together and get R5. And then the other end of R4 combines together to R to go back to point B. This one now shows the current's going to separate out into three branches, and you can see these two are going to clearly be the easiest ones to separate out because those are now clearly in series. Once you reduce those, you might find that those are clearly in parallel with R2. Which then, so you can reduce that stepwise. When it's drawn as a diagonal here, it's going to be very difficult to figure out how it's done. Once you separate it out so you can clearly get current flowing from point A to point B across the page, hopefully you can see that a little bit better. There's one problem with this particular one, and let me show you what it is. If I reduce these R1, R3, that down to a single one, what happens? I get a circuit that looks like this. A, R4, R1, 3, I'm going to call R1, 3, R2, those come back together. How do I draw a, I haven't drawn it quite the way we had it, junction was right there. How can I draw a circuit with one wire in and one wire out? These ones clearly look like they're in parallel, but if I've drawn it, you'll notice that there's one wire here, and one wire here. That's three wires. So does that violate my one wire in, one wire out rule? No. Let me show you why. And this is the one exception. You've got to realize what's happening with these wires. Now, maybe I'll draw it with something in color if I can. You'll notice that this wire here is all electrically connected together. I don't know if you can see that very well. And I made the junction inside my box. I could easily have made the junction outside the box here and now had only that one wire going in. They're electrically connected together with no resistors in between them. So the fact that I've got a junction with three branches going out, I could have split that out into two junctions, each of which have only two branches going out. And I've isolated this group without it. You have to be careful, because anytime you've got wires that are connected without any resistors in the path, you can move around where the wires are connected almost any way you want to. As long as you don't jump over a resistor to place the wire on the other side. So that's one where you've got to be careful about how you apply that rule, but the rule still applies. Okay. I wanted to work through another problem, and this is a problem that's similar to the one we just looked at, but now I'm going to do it with capacitors only, and I know that I've only got about 6 minutes. And let's zoom in, and I've got four capacitors are connected and shown what is their equivalent capacitance. Then I'm going to ask some things about the capacitance in a second. You notice that you can write down the principle, the combinations of series and parallel capacitors can be reduced to equivalent capacitance. We have a technique for doing that. Here I've got a box that I can put around it, one wire in, one wire out. These two are clearly in series. I've written down my knowns. All of the individual capacitors are known. The equivalent capacitance is what I want to find. You'll notice that I have to go stepwise through several steps to get to this equivalent capacitance that's unknown. You can start out by saying the capacitors 2 and 3 are in series. That means you can isolate them with one wire in and one wire out, so that I can use the equivalent capacitance of two that are in series. Here's my isolation equation. Now if I substitute my values 5 microfarads and 10 microfarads, 1 over 5 is 0.2, 1 over 10 is 0.1, so that's 0.3 inverse microfarads that I then invert again to get 3.33 microfarads. And I don't have to do the evaluation step now, but it's useful to do that. You'll notice that when you have two values of capacitance and you do them in this inverse manner, your answer should always be smaller than the smallest of either of these two. This one was 5, this one was 10, and when I combine them together in series, they end up being 3.3. So it's smaller than each of them. That evaluation process helps me make sure that I'm on track. Now what I do is I replace and reduce the circuit, so I take that equivalent capacitance and put it in place of where I had the two. Now I've got three capacitors And it's clearly now obvious that they're all in parallel with each other. Capacitor 1, capacitor 2, 3, and capacitor 4. Because I can put them in parallel, I can now use the equation that adds them linearly. Capacitor 1, capacitor 2, 3, and capacitor 4. I add them up and I get my equivalent capacitance of the four of them now because I've reduced it. And I had to go through two steps to get to that and, but I was able to do it. And you'll notice I went through the isolate step and the substitute and solve step each time. You'll also notice that because I did the inverse ohms here, that I came back to, inverse microfarads here, I came back to units of microfarads. I didn't even bother to go to the 10 to the minus 6th and back. I just kept the unit of microfarad throughout that process, and that will actually work. Now let's see what happens. If this circuit is connected across a 12-volt battery, find the total charge stored and find the charge on each capacitor. Let's put that written down again here. If the circuit's connected across a 12-volt battery, so on. So I'm going to take a 12-volt battery, and I'm going to connect it across this circuit. Let's see if I can find, stepwise, both the total charge and the charge on the individual capacitors. The total charge is going to be the charge on the equivalent capacitor from the external voltage. And the charge on the individual capacitors is going to be from the voltage across each of the individual capacitors. So if you take their individual capacitance and the voltage across that capacitor, you can get the charge on each one individually. So let's do that. Our knowns, we've written down a number of knowns. We've actually calculated the equivalent capacitance of that circuit. And in fact, I'm going to keep track of the intermediate step of the equivalent capacitance of just those two that are in series. That's going to be useful to me later. And then I've got the other knowns that are in there. The unknowns, I want to find the total charge, and I want to find the charges on each of the individual capacitors. Now, one of the things we're going to find is that total charge is going to be related to the charge on the individual capacitors. Okay? Total charge is equal to the equivalent capacitance times the battery voltage. Well, there's the equivalent capacitance. There's the battery voltage, and there's my total charge. I can do the same thing for charges Q1 and Q4 because you'll notice capacitor 1 bridges all the way across from one side of the battery to the other, and capacitor 4 does the same thing, that the two plates of the capacitors are exactly at the two voltages of the ends of the battery. So that if I do Q1 is equal to C1, that the capacitance of capacitor 1 times the battery voltage, I get this charge on it. Same thing for C4. Capacitors 2 and 3 are a little bit more complicated. You'll notice that they have to have the same charge. Well, we talked about why they have to be the same charge. And it turns out it has to be the charge on the equivalent capacitor across the battery voltage. Now there's if you add these up, this charge plus this charge plus this charge ends up equaling the total charge. I guess I've run to the end of my time. Remind me at the beginning of next class period, there is actually a slightly different way of solving for the charges Q2 and Q3. And I'll do that at the beginning of Friday's class.